the first Marquess, his wife, Lady Elizabeth, who was the first Marchioness, she became the kind of last and arguably most important mistress of George IV. He arrived in Dublin and made a beeline for Slane, and so the joke at the time was that the road was straightened so that he could get to his lover all the quicker. So Dad always liked to joke it was the family's contribution to local government road planning.
I'm sitting in the drawing room of centuries-old Slane Castle with its heir apparent, Alex Cunningham.
Otherwise known as Earl of Mount Charles.
Though a Marquess Cunningham has been here in Slane since the early 1700s, the family's history in Ireland reaches further back still.
In the Battle of the Boyne, that happened just a few miles down the road, and Dad likes to say we're on both sides of the battle, watching which way things were swinging, and that battle obviously changed the course of European history.
Despite their long and storied history on this Emerald Isle, Alex's ilk rarely feature in modern Irish culture. There are few plays, less fiction, and virtually no TV shows or films about the Anglo-Irish. In the century since Ireland became a republic, representation of the ascendancy has all but disappeared.
You know, it is a part of Irish history and it shouldn't be swept under the carpet.
So as we celebrate the centenary of Ireland's War of Independence, I'm finding out what happened to the Anglo-Irish, how their descendants live today, and just who are Ireland's last lords.
If you move down through the peerage, you have dukes, marquesses, earls, viscounts, barons, baronets, and there's around about 100 families or so of those in Ireland.
Professor Terence Dooley is head of history at Maynooth University.
I think it would probably be fair to say that there were the poor relations of the peerage within the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. It would have been an aspiration of the Irish aristocratic families to marry their daughters into the British peerage. Wouldn't necessarily have been the case in reverse.
The poor cousins' heyday was the Georgian period. They enjoyed the Dublin season, debuting their daughters at court in London, and drinking, shooting or gambling their way through each other's estates.
The decline begins in the 19th century, and because of the circumstances of the famine where tenants weren't paying their rents, quite a large number of them were forced to sell their houses and their estates. During the War of Independence and the Civil War, about 300 country houses were burned in Ireland because of their old traditional symbolism.
And that's where many of our junior cert history classes will have ended. What happened next is much more hazy. Many of those who once ruled this land quickly absconded when it became a republic to the safety of Britain or the colonies, dropping Irish titles in favour of courtesy ones elsewhere. But a toughened few held on to their land and remained here in the country, and for some it was less turning the coat and rather turning it back.
Many of these houses and families are descended from the old Gaelic, the royalty and aristocracy. It's not just a history of British colonialism. Donnellis House up in County Roscommon, owned by the O'Connor Nashes, you know, and they are descended from the last High Kings of Ireland. I think they're the oldest royal family in Europe.
Justin Green is a board member of Historic Irish Houses, a group that lobbies government and supports homeowners with upkeep grants.
There are a lot of families like that, and many of them spent sort of 500 years fighting against the English, and then in order to hold on to their lands, they had to kind of switch sides and change their religion. It's a complicated history. It's not straightforward.
Equally as complicated is the road by which a hereditary peer or member of the gentry finally integrates in life in a republic. For Justin Green and his family at Cork's Ballyvillane House, the key lay in the inherited property itself.
My parents struggled with farming. You know, it was just a difficult time in the 1980s, and that's when they decided to open up the house as a historic house B&B. We see it as a huge responsibility, and you know, I would certainly see myself as a custodian, and we're just looking after the place and trying to improve it and hand it on in slightly better condition than when we found it. And we all work very hard to preserve these historic properties, and they're a very important part of Ireland's built heritage and are a really important cultural resource for this country. When travellers come over, one of the most popular things people want to do is go and visit a historic house.
However, less than 10% of the historic houses lived in by the Anglo-Irish still stand in Ireland today, with only a few dozen of them in the hands of the families who once lived there. Being an economic centre of a community, particularly in remote areas, was always a key role of these properties. And according to Terence Dooley, it may have saved some of them from demise.
When it came to burning big houses during the revolutionary period, there are petitions that are presented to even the Free State government by employees on estates such as Bessborough and Kilkenny, whereby they're saying, look, can you offer some protection down here? Because if this house goes, then it means serious loss to the local community.
But the time of servants and butlers is now, thankfully, past us. Though Justin Green says homes like his are still an important focal point for the community, perhaps not so much economically, but certainly socially and emotionally too.
One long-term member of staff whose son got married here recently. We also have people who've worked here as students during the summer. Like one of them is now a lawyer in Hong Kong, and his grandfather used to work here on the estate. I remember meeting his grandfather when I was young.
Some of the Anglo-Irish have opened their doors for survival. But for others, adapting to life here has meant nothing short of reinvention. Randall Plunkett, the 21st Baron of Dunsany, might as easily be called Earl of the Environment, with his 12th century estate in Meath now home to Ireland's largest rewilding experiment. But no one has dusted off their stuffy old title quite like Henry Cunningham, the Marquess of Slane, and more recently, the Lord of Rock.
Well, the first gig was in 1981, the year of the hunger strikes. And, you know, this country was in a difficult place at that time. Dad recognised the power of music as a force in terms of bringing people together. And it was pretty extraordinary. You know, greatest Irish rock and roll band at the time, Thin Lizzy were the headline. And U2, fairly early in their career, it was a kind of seminal gig for them. I was 6 years old, but a local lady actually sent a photo to me fairly recently, and she's having her photograph taken with Philo out the front, and he's got her arm around her, and then in the background there's this little kid with runners on, skinny jeans, and no top on, and hair all over the place, and that was me, age 6 years old, kind of getting into the spirit of things.
Forty-odd years later, Alex himself could be called the Baron of Whiskey, launching Slane's own brand of Ishka Baha in 2017. Alex and his father still use their titles, as do Lord and Lady Ross of Birr Castle, and of course Alex Baring, Baron of Revelstoke, the lucky owner of the island of Lambay.
Yes, we're a republic and titles aren't officially recognised, but even if you don't approve of it, they are part of our collective history. You know, I'm very comfortable with where my family sits, providing that we continue to be a net contributor to our local economy and our country at large. And as long as we can do that, then I think we're playing our role.
Some Anglo-Irish peers, however, have dropped the titles entirely. When Thomas Pakenham was presented with the opportunity to become First Lord Silchester and eventually the 8th Earl of Longford, he decided to stay as just plain Tom.
I was working as a journalist in London. So, I mean, it would have been ridiculous to be Lord Silchester, a sort of hack reporter on the Sunday Telegraph. Then I married in 64, came to live here full time, and it would have been equally inappropriate to call myself Lord in what is a republic, because it just seems to me ridiculous for people to use foreign titles in Ireland. Truth is, I didn't wish to be involved. I thought it was all out of date and anachronism, and I still think that.
Whether they take up their titles or cast them aside, the Anglo-Irish we've heard from today are more obviously distinguished by their accents, something Justin Green says can cause a bit of confusion from time to time.
I even got caught speeding the other day, and the Garda leaned in the window near Fermoy on my way to Cork. And he said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from down the road. I grew up there, and he didn't believe me.
And when it comes to identity, it isn't always straightforward for them either.
Sometimes we don't really know who we are at all, because, you know, we feel English in Ireland and Irish in England. It's a kind of schizophrenia we're trying to come to terms with sometimes. Having said that, I've always felt very welcome here and felt part of the community. There's never been any issues that I can remember. Maybe my past is slightly British, but my future and present is very much Irish.
Any tensions that may have divided us do seem to have quelled over the Republic's first century, with a renewed interest in these properties obvious from the public's fascination with Netflix series like Bridgerton and, of course, The Crown. In fact, the Marquess of Sligo, currently resident in Australia, told me he's even considering a move back to his ancient home. But with many of these properties now functioning as businesses, why is it important for taxpayer money to help our last lords hold on to their houses? Is the king of the castle really still the best man for the role?
You know, it's interesting when people look around the house, quite often the things that they're attracted to are the photographs, for example, not just the portraits, because it's about real people and real stories, and having real living working families in these places makes them much more interesting. In a place like this, your work here is never done, you know, it's a lifetime's project. It's all the stuff in the background that you don't get to see, like fixing stuff on the roof or restoring windows. If it's going to survive and thrive, we got to keep, and certainly in my view, keep the families involved, because they are the ones who are most passionate and will go furthest to try and protect what we're lucky enough to live in.
Long live the Lords.